welcome to the September 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. We start tonight with our newest member of the Outbeat radio team, Del Phoenix. You can hear him on the fifth Sunday, and tonight he's going to share some of his background and plans for the new show. Raif Drazi is here with this month's HIV update, and my co-host Finn Dearhart will sit down for a conversation with Darcy Drollinger, San Francisco's official drag laureate. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, September 28th, 2025. I'd love to change the world. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of September 28, 2025. Vice President J.D. Vance suggested earlier this month that transgender people in the United States pose, quote, a domestic terrorist threat, despite a wide body of evidence to the contrary. Vance appeared on Fox News' Jesse Waters Primetime, where he blamed the September 10th assassination of right-wing Christian nationalist activist and Trump ally Charlie Kirk on, quote, left-wing political radicalization, end quote. And he speculated that the suspected shooter, Tyler Robinson, was probably radicalized by, quote, trans-related stuff, end quote. In a clip from the interview posted to X by journalist Ken Klippenstein, Waters asked the vice president whether he considers, quote, the militant transgender movement to be, quote, a domestic terrorist threat. Vance responded, quote, if you are encouraging people to commit acts of violence against the United States government or against your fellow Americans, absolutely. You're involved in a terrorist movement, end quote. According to Klippenstein, two national security officials told him that the administration is discussing a plan in which the FBI would consider transgender suspects as a subset of its nihilistic violent extremist threat category. In reality, though, evidence shows that the current federal administration's narrative of transgender violence is entirely baseless. Both the New York Times columnist Linda Palgren and the LA Times point to data from the Violence Prevention Project at Hamline University, which indicates that less than 1% of shootings, where four or more people were wounded in public, were committed by transgender people, and that over 97% of the mass killings were committed by cisgender men. Earlier this month, an analysis of the crime data by PolitiFact also showed that the overwhelming majority of shootings were perpetrated by cisgender men. And according to the Williams Institute at UCLA School of Law, transgender people are four times more likely than cisgender people to be victims of violent crime. And in Oklahoma, the Supreme Court in that state ruled last week that Superintendent of Public Instruction Ryan Walters and the Oklahoma State Board of Education cannot force schools to incorporate the Bible and Christianity into new social studies standards. One religious freedom organization hailed the ruling as a victory for the separation of church and state. In June of 2024, Walters and the school board issued a guidance saying that K-12 school lessons should be focused on the Bible's influence on history, literature, music, and other arts and culture. Walters' guidance commanded that every classroom contain a physical copy of the Bible and copy of the Ten Commandments, the U.S. Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence. Following the order, about 33 Oklahoma parents, children, public school teachers, and faith leaders joined a lawsuit, alleging that the guidance violated the separation of church and state rulemaking laws. The plaintiffs in the case were represented by the American Civil Liberties Union for the Separation of Church and State and the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law. In its ruling, the court prohibited the implementation of the new social studies standards and instructed state officials not to spend any state funds on them. And here in California, a judge ruled that in Orange County, the library system violated a state law with its policy of restricting young people's access to, quote, sexually explicit materials. Earlier this month, Orange County Superior Court Judge Lindsay Martinez sided with plaintiffs who sued the Huntington Beach Library, arguing that the policy violates the state's Constitution and Freedom to Read Act. This law was signed by Gavin Newsom back in 2024 and forbids state-funded public libraries from excluding from their collections or limiting access to materials solely based on race, nationality, gender identity, sexual orientation, religion, disability, political affiliation, or any other characteristic, or on the socioeconomic status of the subject, author, source, or perceived intended audience. The judge rejected the City of Huntington Beach's argument that the Freedom to Read Act is unconstitutional and accepted the plaintiff's claim that the restriction had already been implemented. Her decision bans Huntington Beach from enacting its book ban. And here in San Francisco, the city reports seeing a small increase in new HIV diagnoses last year, rising from an all-time low of 140 cases reported in 2023 to 146 cases reported in 2024. The report shows an increase in diagnoses among Black people and women. Overall, 94% of people diagnosed with HIV in 2024 were linked to care within 1 month, and 79% achieved a viral load below 200 after receiving antiviral treatment. For Outbeat Radio News,
I'm Greg Moraglia.
My first guest tonight is Del Phoenix. He's the newest member of the Outbeat Radio team here on KRCB Radio and brings the trans community voice to our show, something that's been missing for quite a long time. You can hear Del on Those Months with a Fifth Sunday. Del, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, glad to have you here and introduce you more to our listeners. You've done a couple of shows on the Outbeat series so far, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. But let's start with getting to know you a little bit, where you grew up and how you came to Santa Rosa and then ended up at KRCB.
So grew up in the Valley, Stockton, Sacramento areas, moved up to Grass Valley, lived there for about 17 years. And then in 2016, I made some connections out here through KOWS FM LP radio station, and I was with KVMR in Grass Valley as a broadcaster and a board member for 11, 12 years. So I had the radio connections already to the community, and, you know, kind of set my sights on moving out here over time and made that happen. So I've been here for not quite 2 years.
Great. What have you found in Santa Rosa or Sonoma County that you like the best?
The beach and the redwoods, definitely. Yeah. People, you know, as much as I loved the foothills, like they were, you know.
Sure.
It wasn't, it was no longer meeting my needs to live there. Yeah. So yeah. I needed more diversity, and just needed to be around more people in a larger group.
Sure. Well, we've got such a great community here, and I think, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area and came up here, because that's where I met my husband and ended up moving up here. And I lived in Napa for a long time, and Napa was great. It's probably one of the most comfortable places I've ever lived, but Sonoma County is really special.
There's an energy here.
Well, there is. And you mentioned, you know, the beach and the redwoods. There's such a diversity of space, not just people, right. but space. And it doesn't feel as crowded. It doesn't feel maybe quite as claustrophobic as Napa can feel sometimes. And it's really got some of the most beautiful coastline of anywhere that I've ever seen.
It does. It does. And I mean, before I moved out here, I spent a lot of time coming out here every few months. And, you know, I made a connection to nature here. And I remember driving towards Bodega Bay at one point and just thinking, this is where I come home to myself. Yeah. And that was what, you know, prompted me to make the decision, you know, moving from, you know, a desire to live here to actually making steps towards that happening.
Good for you. So your show airs on the fifth Sunday, which, you know, historically has been what we've called Outbeat Extra. And I'm really excited to have a regular show, a regular voice on that fifth Sunday. And I'm even more excited about having a trans voice on our series. I think that has been missing for just a long time. But, you know, talk to us about, you've done a couple of shows. You obviously have a vision for what you want to do. Tell us about what your plans are. What's the theme of the show? Give us the scoop.
So it's a little bit interesting. When I was told that there would, you know, it's a possible opening with Outbeat Collective, the fifth Sundays was perfect for me because I was really looking for something part-time. Mm-hmm. And I've been a music broadcaster. I've done a lot of interviews and I've done some emergency news coverage, especially the fires and, you know, from 2017 moving forward, but I haven't done a lot of public affairs programming. So this is a little bit of a shift for me, where I'm blending, you know, music, spoken word, and interviews to highlight trans voices. One of the things I really love about Outbeat that's already happening is, you know, the coverage of academics and professionals and organizations within the trans and gender expansive community. So I'm wanting to just spotlight the everyday voices of our community.
I love that. So tell us about what who you've had so far on the show, and then what your hopes are for the next couple of fifth Sundays.
So my first show was in March, and it was perfect timing for Trans Day of Visibility. However, it came along very quickly. I was not prepared. So I used a couple of interviews that I had done with trans musicians and activists, Ryan Quesada and Eli Conley. And so I used those for that first show to just highlight the importance and the intersections of music and activism and the importance of pride and visibility in our community. And then my second show happened to be in June, Pride Month. And so just because of the political atmosphere, I wanted to bring in voices that talked about like how it is that we're coping, how we're dealing with the political atmosphere. And I have a friend who is a reverend and another friend who's a therapist. And so I interviewed both of them on holding space and keeping faith and self-care in these times, and community care in these times.
Boy, is that important?
And then my last show was that's kind of interesting. I had heard about the poet Andrea Gibson dying, and they have been one of my favorite poets for a long time. And I wanted to do a spoken word special, but I wanted to juxtapose different types of spoken words. So I reached out to community members and came up with a couple of people that I know who are comedians within the community. And so I juxtaposed Andrea Gibson's poetry with two interviews with these comedians, Auntie Vice, who is an educator, and Temple the Bard. And so that was just last month. And then coming up in November, we have Trans Day of Remembrance. So I'll be focusing on that. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing yet, but I will have something.
Yeah, there's
So,
certainly a lot of room there for sure. I'm curious though, you mentioned this is, a part-time situation for you. All of us have other day jobs that we do, and so tell us about yours.
So I'm actually in transition right now. I moved up here, and I've been working in the field of addiction medicine, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm transitioning back into private practice currently. So I'm in this weird little in-between state at the moment. But my private practice is primarily working with LGBTQ plus community, disability community, and addiction populations. So I have a background with a bachelor's in sociology with a focus on LGBT and gender studies, and I have a master's in social work with a focus on the intersections of LGBTQ identity and trauma. So
Wow.
I bring all of that to the work that I
A
do.
lot of great expertise there in those degrees, that's for sure. Awesome. Nice to have you in our community and available. And I'm sure there's plenty of folks who are ready to reach out to you. I mean, let's face it, this is a horrible time. I was going to say a rough time, but let's just call it a horrible time for trans folks, gender non-conforming folks, gender non-binary folks, anybody who doesn't fit within that gender binary. The messaging is really horrific.
It is.
What are you seeing here in Sonoma County? I mean, I think sometimes we think we live in a bubble here, but it's not a perfect bubble.
Well, that's a little bit harder for me because I haven't been working in the county. I've been working in Napa County, and that's taken up the majority of my time. So I haven't seen as much as I would like to here specifically. And I haven't had the chance to get into community the way that I had hoped yet. But that's going to be changing as I'm settling back into private practice and have more control over my time. So that I can branch out further into the community. But what I do see and what I notice in terms of my own experience within the community here is that I still feel safer here than I did where I previously lived. But the political atmosphere makes it more difficult for all of
Sure.
us. I'm seeing a lot of burnout in general within the community just because of the amount of emotional labor that we're carrying between our activism, our day jobs, and just our lives, especially for those of us who are visibly trans. So those of us who don't pass, those of us who are non-binary.
Sure. And I work in Napa currently, and I've worked in Napa. I've taught in Napa now for, gosh, 39 years. I know I have a sense of what the community is like. What's your sense of what the community is like
In Napa, it's, I mean, I'm not in Napa proper. I've been working in Calistoga, and I've been in a bubble there working in addiction medicine. So I really don't have a sense of that part of the community either. It's more just generalized. Sure. Where I've worked has been a microcosm of, you know, the greater community. And, you know, in terms of, I want to say percentages of populations, you know, that are represented there are definitely unevenly distributed towards, you know, cis white men privilege as a majority of clients that we serve. But in terms of the interactions in the community, it very much represents what we're seeing in society. And I know I've definitely had my experiences at work. I am out, but it's also in that particular field, it was really none of my clients' business what my gender identity was. So unless I was working with a community member and it was relevant. So, but I definitely had some experiences that were difficult to navigate in terms of gender identity, how I was treated, how, you know, people taking me seriously as a clinician, those kinds of things. So my work life, it's been a little bit different. So,
yeah, I had a meeting with some folks from LGBTQ Connection recently, and they have offices. You're familiar with them.
Yes.
Yeah, so they have offices in both Sonoma County here in Santa Rosa, as well as in Napa. And one of the observations that they made was that especially their older trans community is that people are, they're so afraid they're not leaving their homes, literally not leaving their homes because they don't feel safe.
Right.
And that really struck me, that people would have such a sense of fear that they can't, that they struggle to leave or that they won't leave their homes at all.
Right. And that goes back to passability. Those of us who don't pass or who are visibly trans definitely have a harder time navigating being out in society. You know, like I said, I do feel safer here than where I previously lived. This is actually where I came when I was transitioning as well, to explore my own identity and how I expressed that. I feel safer here, and I don't always feel safe. Walking around the area where I live, it's definitely, you know, a little bit more of a suburban kind of an energy and a little bit more family oriented. And I feel this like need to just kind of keep my head down at times, not always. And yet I know that this area is politically pretty open, you know, to my identity. I've never had any specific interactions with people, you know, one-on-one here that were transphobic. It's more the general energy, like social media, what we hear on the news, you know, that feeds the fear.
Right.
And then it's, so there's this weird, it's hard to describe. There's this weird thing of like, I wake up every day and I know that, you know, based on the news, the world is against me for who I am. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what it feels like when I hear the news. And yet life goes on, just like always. There's nothing really new from the day-to-day experience other than the fact that I never know what's going to happen. And there's this chance that's kind of out there. It's really ambiguous and intangible.
Yeah.
So that's the piece.
Tension for sure.
It really is.
Yeah. So what do you think? The source of the angst that Republicans have, and let's call it, and this is a political issue, right? Where does the angst with transgender people come from that the Republican Party seems to have? I mean, it's a relatively small percentage of our overall population. I think the last survey we talked about on the news was 2.8% identifies as trans or in that gender questioning, gender non-binary area. Not a lot of people overall. Why are they so focused on this?
Right. So the shortest answer I can offer without teaching a gender 101 is that, like looking at it from a sociological standpoint, first and foremost, we need to understand that gender and sex are two different things, and that gender is a construct that helps to shape our society in terms of roles. in that family is the foundation of most societies. And in Western civilization, we recognize family through the binaries of male, female, mom, dad, sister, brother, right? So there are a lot of other societies now and throughout history that have made the space to recognize and include transgender and gender expansive people who don't fit the gender binary. But we don't have that here. We have only been visibly out for the past few decades, even though we've been a part of society for as long as people have existed. Politics, by their very nature, are about power and control. And one of the first questions a sociologist learns to ask is who benefits? So, like, by our very existence, a transgender and gender expansive community are disrupting these social narratives. And so we're being villainized by groups who want to maintain a rigid control over society. And we're seeing that now, not just with, our population, but with a lot of groups. They're trying to maintain this control through norms and rules that uphold specific political platforms that uphold political power. So it's to me, it's not so much of a source of angst for a specific political party, but rather the current group of politicians that are in power who are taking advantage of a community that's not well understood by our society. And, it creates a division by scapegoating and villainizing a very vulnerable group of people. So,
I think you hit the nail on the head right there, is that there is a lack of awareness, education, and overall knowledge about gender. And you mentioned that it's such a structural part of our society. Everything has in the past, to date at least, revolved around male and female. Department stores are organized that way. And so the idea that there's something more than male and female, it just disrupts everything. And if you don't understand, and if you don't take the time to understand it and to learn and to look at the scientific research and then meet people and talk about their experience, then this just whole all becomes overwhelming.
Well, and again, like the idea that we conflate gender and sex, right? Intersex people alone break up the binary of male and female, but they only represent 1.7% of the population in total. And unless you want to consider, and we haven't done enough research, we don't have the equipment and the funding and everything that's needed to do this kind of research, but I have a feeling that transgender and gender expansive people are an extension of the intersex community in ways that we haven't discovered yet. So, but like when we're talking about binaries, I think it's also important to recognize that this isn't just like a binary Republican Democrat thing either. A lot of Democrats haven't stepped up to protect our rights at all levels of government. And some have only championed our rights when it, supported them and was convenient for their platform, and some will very easily discard us if that's what serves their platform in the moment. And I think we need to be very cognizant of that right now.
Well, what would you like to see the trans community do? When I say trans community, I'm talking about the non-cisgender community, however you identify in that area. I mean, I think we'd like to say that the entire LGBT community should be standing up, but of course we have our own conflicts and disagreements about, the affiliation there. So let's talk specifically about the trans community and maybe even think about those folks who are feeling paralyzed right now. What does
Well,
your
I think there, I think therein lies the problem is that trans community members are already doing enough. We are exhausted. Most of us are already engaged in some form of activism. Our lives are often just by our very existence a form of activism. And what we really need right now is for our voices to be heard and for allies to step up and to help support us to advocate for our needs and protect us and our rights. We need to be seen for who we are. And so, of course, visibility is important, right? And telling our stories is important, but there's also a safety, piece in that, I know I would never. I would never tell a person that they shouldn't do whatever they need to do to feel safe, mm-hmm. right? So if a person doesn't feel safe being out, I'm not going to force them to out themselves sure. in any capacity. But for those of us who are willing and able to speak up and to tell our stories and to, you know, help shape the work and inform the work that we need our allies to do, I think that's important for us. And also for us to practice our own self-care and community care as we always have, right? Because of the amount of emotional labor that it just takes to survive.
Yep. And thus the reason why it is so important to have your show as part of the Outbeat Radio team. So right. I think it's more important and so timely, and I appreciate the fact that you're part of our group now. Where can people go to follow you in between those fifth Sundays?
So my social media presence is pretty quiet these days, just for my own sanity. But I do have a professional website, and that's del-phoenix.com. So my first name, del-phoenix.
Perfect. And if you missed that website, we will put it on our own website at outbeatnews.com. You will find the show scrolling across the top under show notes. Just click it, and you'll be able to get connected and follow Del and his work. Del Phoenix, welcome aboard, and thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight.
All right. Thank you so much.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. And here is Ray F. DeRozzi with this month's HIV update.
Hello, and welcome to the HIV News Roundup for September 2025. The HIV field has continued to see both pressure and promise. New policy shifts, funding threats, program disruptions, and community convenings that may reset the direction of the fight. Today, I'll cover some of the major stories this month. In a dramatic development, the UN proposed phasing out UNAIDS by the end of 2026, merging its functions into other UN agencies. This is driven by severe funding shortfalls and has led to an approximately 55% planned staff cut already. This is a stark escalation when previously the primary worry was funding cuts destabilizing HIV programs. Now the very institutional architecture may be dismantled. Critics fear that losing a dedicated global disease-specific body will weaken coordination, advocacy, and accountability precisely when HIV funding is fragmented. UNAIDS has served as a convening authority and data tracker in the HIV response. Its downgrading or elimination could leave gaps in oversight, especially in setting norms, maintaining political pressure, and supporting low- and middle-income countries. One of the more dramatic stories in September involves U.S.-funded contraceptives and HIV prevention medicines that have been stuck in a warehouse in Geel, Belgium, since funding was frozen under U.S. foreign aid policy earlier in the year. The stockpile includes more than 50,000 bottles of HIV inhibitors, oral, injectable, implantable contraceptives, and millions of condoms. Reports in July had suggested the U.S. planned to incinerate much of the stock, but Belgian authorities have intervened. Local laws in Flanders ban destruction of properly stored medicines if still usable, and so far, no official request to destroy has been granted. The underlying causes trace back to these ongoing issues. Foreign aid freezes, USAID shutdowns, supply chain disruptions, and political decisions that are disconnecting procurement of prevention meds from global delivery. The warehouse crisis makes concrete the human cost of those decisions. Medicines that could prevent HIV or serve ongoing treatment are being held in limbo or threatened with destruction. On September 18th, the U.S. unveiled its America First Global Health Strategy, which reorients foreign aid toward bilateral deals and greater country ownership, with HIV PEPFAR featured as a priority area. Complementing this, in early September, the U.S. committed to purchasing 2 million doses of lenacapavir, the twice-yearly HIV prevention injection, for low-middle-income countries through PEPFAR and the Global Fund. This aligns with earlier announcements that Gilead's licensing and PEPFAR support would enable lenacapavir rollouts in high-burden countries. However, under the new aid approach, PEPFAR and other programs will face tighter scrutiny for overhead, efficiency, and alignment with U.S. strategic interests. The WHO issued updated HIV service delivery guidelines with three major shifts. Strong recommendation to integrate non-communicable diseases care, including diabetes, hypertension, within HIV clinics. Integrate mental health services for depression, anxiety, alcohol use disorders, and enhanced evidence-based adherence interventions, especially peer and tailored support. These changes emphasize holistic, patient-centered care instead of disease siloing. In the U.S., following FDA approval earlier this year, lenacapavir is now formally strongly recommended as a PrEP option. Meanwhile, the House GOP has floated eliminating HIV prevention funding in the U.S., slashing CDC global HIV work, and gutting the Ryan White program. A modeling study published earlier this month estimated that ending the Ryan White program would, over time, increase new HIV infections by approximately 49% nationwide by 2030. This month, the HIV community gathered for USCHA 2025 in Washington, D.C., under the theme, Aging with HIV. The conference was especially resonant against the backdrop of funding and institutional risks. Over 3,000 attendees, advocates, providers, public health officials, community members participated in plenaries, workshops, poster sessions, and policy labs. Key threads in USCHA included the need of aging populations with HIV, comorbidities, polypharmacy, long-term care, equity and prevention, and strategies for sustaining programs amid financial uncertainty. Sessions discussed how to defend domestic HIV programs in the U.S. and how to push global actors to maintain stable, accountable funding. Also, the conference reinforced that community voices must be central in any scaling of new prevention tools, not just new tech, but who gets them and under what conditions. September confirms that previous concerns about funding cuts have deepened into institutional disruption, strategy shifts, and access fragility. Scientific advances are transitioning from promise to practice, but scaling them equitably is now a key hurdle, especially amid funding tensions. Guidelines are evolving to meet real-world needs, more integration, person-centered care, and smarter monitoring. But risks ahead are looming. If UNAIDS is dismantled, global coordination and accountability may suffer, increasing fragmentation. The U.S. aid shift toward bilateralism may discourage multilateral cooperation just when it's most needed. Proposed domestic cuts to U.S. HIV programs could undercut progress in prevention and treatment at home. Implementation gaps may worsen, especially for marginalized populations, if community-driven programming is cut. Science and innovation remain vital, but we cannot let them be outpaced by institutional and funding retrenchment. Progress is not just about new drugs. It's about stewardship of global systems, protection of rights, and resilient delivery models. The coming months will likely be decisive. To learn more about what's happening with HIV this month, check out my YouTube channel found under the name Raif Darazi. For Outbeat News in Depth, I'm Raif Darazi.
Thanks, Raif. Well, Darcy Drollinger is a longtime artist, performer, and San Francisco's official drag laureate. My co-host, Finn Dearhart, had a chance to visit with Darcy to learn more about her history.
Yes, we have actor, writer, director, choreographer, producer, and owner of The Oasis, Darcy Drollinger. Welcome to Outbeat News.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're really an inspiring performer and just all around incredible person, and have been instrumental in my life and in many, 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 many lives in the Bay Area and beyond. And I'm just really grateful that you're here.
You know, it has been a journey, and I'm very curious and excited about what's happening next. So.
Yes, you've got big things going on. And actually, I just want to just kind of name, too, during the pandemic, your recordings of Hot Trash, which these are all on, most of these are on YouTube still, so people can find these and we'll have in the show notes. But those kept me going during the pandemic.
That was really, really fun. And, you know, it was something that really was birthed out of all of these people not having anything to do and any, you know, way to express ourselves. And it was also challenging because there wasn't a lot of news those first few weeks. Like, no one could leave their house. So, like, you know, all there was like celebrities fighting over tweets, basically, you know.
Actually, I think this is touching on what I think is so impacting about your work in my life is you're a performer, but I don't really consider you just a performer. It's almost like a shamanic situation that you have going on. And I remember at one point you told me that you had wanted to be a minister, I think, a long time ago. And I'm wondering if you still see yourself in that way.
You know, I did want that, and I also feel like I would be drawing from the same sort of creative well that I draw from for everything else. My dance class is a little bit of my Sunday sermon, and while we spend most of the time dancing, you know, in church, you spend most of your time singing. And I think being together and doing something that you basically breathe, right? So you breathe in, and lots of breath oxygenates the blood, and it actually just makes you feel high. And when you're doing something like that with a group, I noticed this also when we were just closed Jurassic Park the musical, which was a sing-along musical, and you like putting them there singing at the same time, it elevates everyone's emotion. And I think a lot of times people go to church, and when they feel that elevation, they're like, I am filled with the spirit. And that you are, but you're also filled with this communal exaltation, this communal energy that comes from both doing something together, but also doing something together that breathes, that forces you to breathe. Singing and dancing force you to breathe. And so it elevates you, and it also opens your mind, right? I think so. And you know, I talk a little bit at the end of my dance classes, and I really talk about whatever comes into my mind at the moment, right? Or
I love it.
something that is very spontaneous, but it always feels, you know, not to be too woo-woo, but like I feel a little bit like I'm channeling.
Darcy started a dance class. The way he's what they're talking about right now is sexitude. And I've been to this class, and it's one of these like things where I'm not a very good dancer. I'm a good dancer when I can just freestyle, but oh my God, I was like humbled. I
Well,
watch a few people who are super serious about this choreography and really, really good. And I'm like getting three counts at a time and then just like hopeless.
but you know, I have watched people not give up, and they come back, and I mean, I only really know like 50 moves. I just put them in different orders. So once you learn the moves, and honestly, I tell people, class is not about being perfect. It's about being you, right? Being fabulous. And I'd much, you know, rather have people just get everything wrong, but like work a sexy face and feel good, and they don't have to get it right, right? It's not about being, perfect. It's about being, in quotes, fabulous. Really, what I really try and push for people nowadays in class is, what if there was no such word as mistake? There was no wrong, right? So it's just we're doing something. It may not be like everybody else, but what happens to us is we instantly collapse. We instantly crumble. Like, oh God, I screwed up. I messed up. And if you could brainwash yourself and be like, mistakes, there isn't such a thing. Like, you can't do anything wrong. You can do what everyone else is doing, but even if you don't do what everyone else is doing, that's okay. But we're so trained, and we like, and I feel it all the time too, where you just like, you do something, you make a mistake, and you just fall apart from making the mistake in your head, and you berate yourself. But what if we didn't do that? Like, what if we could slowly unravel this idea of that word even, you know, anything? Because really, when you think about it, life is one long path, right? It never actually leads really anywhere. It just keeps going. And you're gonna fall down. You're gonna skin your knees. You're gonna like, you could really fall down hard, but it's about how you get back up, right? And if we can just get used to it being okay to fall down and get back up and not have it be such a like catastrophe when we fall down, metaphorically, then you know, you have a lot more freedom, and failure doesn't present itself all the time, because failure, again, is a construct we have in our mind. There is no such thing as failure there in nature. Right? There's life and death, and there's fire and wind and birth and all the things that, you know, you look at nature like, but there is no such thing as failure. There is no such thing as mistakes.
See, you're doing it right now. You're doing the thing. They're doing it. They're doing the. This is why Darcy Drawlander is incredible. You know what I think? What it's touching, Darcy, is it makes me think of the word vulnerability. And there was a few years ago that I saw Sexitude, the group, and you perform at Pride. And it was like this moment where I was actually feeling very sensitive because this was like post-first Trump. Yeah, I don't remember exactly what year this was, but it was a very sensitive time, as they all are. And after the performance, you gave this little, it was like what you just did right there, you know, and really touched people's hearts in this way. And I thought, you know, what Darcy is doing, people need so much. It's yes, you're performing, but you're also inviting people into an experience with you. And it feels very connected in a way that I think is just like, not all performers do that. And I wish that they would. And something about that was just so powerful. And I actually cried. I was like crying at Pride, just being like, oh my God, this person. I don't know. Do you think about vulnerability in the way that you inhabit your performance? Or you're quite funny. You know, there's like the camp, there's the funny, you know, very incredible wit. But how you must be thinking about that, or maybe it's just something that you inhabit as a person just naturally.
Well, I think that I actually think you have to be vulnerable to be a good actor. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, I think you have to be vulnerable even more so to be a comedic actor. Like comedy is, in my opinion, it can be quite dangerous because really what happens if you don't get the laugh? You know, you look at someone like Bea Arthur, who was amazing because she would do these long takes, right? And it is like, okay, you're gonna do the slow burn and the audience is gonna laugh and then they're gonna not laugh. And what you're hoping is that they're gonna laugh even harder after you do this hold for long enough. But if they don't, it's gonna be a disaster. So there is a bravery there's being brave to be a comedian for sure. But I also think, there has to be vulnerability or the audience can't connect with you and they can't really laugh with you or at you without some sense of vulnerability. And you can, the audience can smell it.
If you totally. Want,
right? They can tell. I can see immediately when I can see someone's process where they're like, everything is calculated and I can tell when I'm watching that performance. I'll chuckle, but it will never make me really laugh because I don't believe it. Like I am not swept up in who you are because you are not in the moment. So being in the moment and being vulnerable and being honest is, I think, in my personal opinion, key to comedy, but also, you know, I do a lot of send-ups of other, you know, of shows, you know, Golden Girls and Sex and the City, but besides doing my own work. And, I feel like you have to, I'm not making fun of the characters. I am working at making them funny, but making them also honest. And I even think that, you know, I'm working on my second Champagne movie right now, and I'm really like watching that. And I did not come up with this. Someone said watching me do Champagne is like watching a, you know, a human embodiment of Miss Piggy. And, you know, and I take that because, well, here's the thing, Miss Piggy is actually an amazing character. And she is so raw and vulnerable. And she can go from loving you to hating you in literally 1 second, you know. And but she does it with such, everything is so, like, it is her honesty. And so I am obsessed with Miss Piggy as an actress.
Well, I love this so much. Actually, I could kind of see that connection too. I'm wondering, can you share with the listeners some of the newer ventures that you're involved in right now and how we can all still support not only the shows and performances, but some of the newer work that you're doing as well in the community?
Well, we have Oasis is still going strong. We're in our 11th year. We are going to wind things up at the end of the year.
Which is so sad.
It is
so
sad, but look, we lasted much longer than Studio 54.
That's my I don't want to let it go. I have to just be honest. I don't want to let it go just yet. But
you know what? Well, you know, here's the thing. Things end and things begin. And this has been this amazing decade in San Francisco where I feel really proud of of creating this special, you know, queer art and nightlife combination that has really, you know, I feel like changed my life and changed a whole lot of other people's lives, both performers and audience members. And, you know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm still going to be here. I started my nonprofit, Oasis Arts, which is not going anywhere either. So if people would like to, you know, see us continue,
yeah,
and see what blossoms, then, you know, helping support Oasis Arts would be, you know, an amazing thing to continue, you know, donating, volunteering. You know, if you know someone, I mean, we live in a 60-mile radius with more billionaires than anywhere in the world.
Seriously. Like,
there could be, you know, a little bit of love from one of those people could really go a long way for what I offer for the community. You know, we won't be able to do as much work. Last year, Oasis Arts and Oasis working together, we produced 352 events. Which,
wow,
crazy, wow, right? Now, a lot of times cool. We'll do two or three events in a day, but that is a lot of events. We paid artists almost $800,000. I'm very proud of that. I'd love to be able to go to a million. We had over 48,000 people buy tickets. We've produced the Pride stage. We've produced the stage at Outside Lands for the last 3 years. You know, we did the MoMA Gala. We've done a lot of, you know, other things as well out that are outside of our walls. But for the most part, you know, we've been able to do all of this because we have a space. We can't, we won't be able to do all of this without a space. But, you know, there might be a situation where a space would present itself down the line. But in the meantime, we will work in other venues, creating things. I mean, I personally would like a little bit of time to do some of my own creative work. I will admit, you know, I have been, you know, I'm working on my film and I do get to have my creative outlets, but I have also not written something brand new for a number of years, and I've spent the last 5 years really working at supporting other artists' work and other artists' ability to sort of, you know, grow their work. And I'm very proud of that, but I also feel like I need to recharge my creative life. And so while this is sad, I'm also really excited
to, yeah,
like spend some time with me.
Yeah.
I literally work like 17 hours a day every day of the week, and while I get so much out of what we do and I'm very proud of what I do, I, you know, don't have a lot of personal life, and I don't have a lot of creative personal life. And so I'm looking forward to seeing what happens around that. I'd like to write a book around creating Oasis and becoming the Drag Laureate. I feel like the last 10 years have been really epic. When I look back at 2015, I opened Oasis. I did Rocky Horror for the first time. Now I'm doing it in the 10th year. I did Golden Girls for the first time. Now in our 11th year, you know, so much has changed. Like, so a decade ago, my life took a huge turn, and I didn't realize what that all meant at the time, you know, and then everything that happened coming out of the pandemic, becoming the sole owner of the club, starting the nonprofit, becoming the Drag Laureate. It was, that's what I mean. It feels like the last 10 years has been 40 years when you look at all the stuff that has happened, and I'm super happy about it. And I am really excited to see what happens next, if I can release some things. And I know that it's hard, and I'm not stopping the club purely because of that. It became economically impossible to support people the way that I want to and have been with the economics of what's happening. You know, it's we started the nonprofit so we could support the artists and the performers that we that inhabit our stage, and really really do the work to support them. And I think that's the thing that people don't see. It's not only, you know, giving them a space, but it is, you know, giving them tech time, giving them all this tech to play with, giving them the support of everyone who works for me that is actually there supporting them, making them feel like they're in a place that really is happy to have them there, rather than just a nightclub or a theater that's an hourly rental or whatever, that really isn't working at cultivating what they're trying to do. So
100% community.
It's creating community, and
it is,
you know, it's, but it, you know, it isn't as easy. I you know, I've got a ton of the money that we raise, the nonprofit is almost 100% community driven. We do get some grants, and, you know, I am grateful for the grants we get. But we, for sure, especially in this world that we're living in now, in this administration, there's really no federal grants for us at all. We have everything that the boxes that you check to not give us the grants, right? You
know,
LGBT, trans, you know,
dangerous drag performers.
We can't say the word diversity anymore. Basically, drag queens and strippers. No one's going to give money, you know, because they do not believe that is art. And I feel like my whole life's work is justifying that, yes, drag queens and strippers are art. And basically, anything is art. It's intention. And, like, you know, you can make something very, you know, benign or mundane into something beautiful, depending on how you create it. I mean, I talk about that in dance class. You can walk down the street like you're walking to Walgreens, or you can walk down the street like you're walking to Prada or Gucci. And it's, you know what I mean? I use those metaphors, but, like, you can live your life.
God help us. Yeah.
I'm just saying, like,
no, I
love
you it.
Can live your life sort of as wonderful, as exciting or as not exciting as you want, but taking something like that, it's just like the Buddhists say, like, right, a teacup can be a teacup or it can be a weapon depending on your intention.
Yes,
I feel like everything else is the same way. You can walk through the world, literally walk through the world and be, you know, just living it as mundane and boring as possible, or you can walk through the world full of energy and full of imagination and curiosity and fabulousness, right? And I talk about it a lot, about finding our fabulous, because it's not about putting on wigs and dresses and makeup and all the things we think fabulous is, right? Fabulous is being authentic, right? Because authenticity, like vulnerability, is what makes people fall in love with you.
And yes,
we see art because we want to fall in love, right? You go see music and dance and or hear music and see dance, visual arts, anything. And when it's good, it touches your heart. And
yeah,
like, you do a little bit fall in love. And, you know, I'm not talking romantic love necessarily, but, like, that is what we connect to. And when someone is authentic, we can connect to them. And every single person is different. Every single person's DNA is unique. And so all of our, like, I talk about that in dance class too, like, give me a sexy face, because everyone's sexy face is going to be a little different. Dance the way you dance, because it's going to be different than everybody else. And if you can get into that, and, like, you can fall in love with that of yourself, you can open that up. And when people fall in love with you, they want to spend time with you. They want to be in the room with you. They want to say yes to you. Your whole life changes. So and then you inspire other people to want to be that authentic, right? Mm-hmm. That's when the world really changes, because we're not so busy worrying about what someone said or how they look. We're getting into living this amazing life. And Neil Neil deGrasse, is that his name? Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Yeah, the astrophysicist.
Yes, he talked about the fact that there are all of the billions and billions of atoms. And they come together and make a person. Mm-hmm. How come? And then there's so many billions of atoms that never become a person. How do we all get so lucky to become people? Right? Mm-hmm. He's like, we should celebrate the fact that we get to die. Because we get to live, and all these other atoms didn't get to have this experience. So
you're doing it again. You're proving my. You're proving Darcy Drolinger is a performer, but Darcy Drolinger actually is like a is something about opening the heart. And I'm so grateful for the work that you are doing. How can people follow your work? Where would they go? And how can they support the community? I know we're coming up on January, where Oasis is closing. So as we conclude, let's give people directives.
Yes. All right. Well, I think people can, they should come to Oasis as much as possible.
Yes.
You know, it is magic. It's magic to be in the audience. It's magic to be in community. It's magic to sing and laugh and all the things you get to do there. But yes, they should come as much as possible and witness it and help us pay our giant debt. Buying drinks and tickets. And I think that, you know, people can check out oasisartsinc.org. That's the website for Oasis Arts, and look at the different ways that you could participate and support us. You can check out my website, darcydrolinger.com. You know, there's all the places you can come to take a dance class, get inspired, move your body.
And we'll put all those links in the notes for people as well.
I think, you know, and I think right now is a really hard time for us all, as, you know, what I see around me as a queer person and being with queer and trans people in my life, every day of my life, it is a scary place to be when, like, literally we are actively being erased.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not a theory anymore. It's really happening.
Yeah.
And our only power is community. You know, I think sometimes we get so worked up because we have no control of what's going on that we sort of attack each other and we eat our own. And we have to get to a place where we can really feel like we can love and even educate each other, but in a positive way. And stop canceling each other.
I'm so with you, Darcy. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your light, your art, and just making an impact in the world. Listeners, please check out Darcy's work. Go to the Oasis if you can. Help support the arts. And we will look forward to seeing you in your fabulous glam.
Yes, and come see Rocky Horror. We're having an immersive Rocky Horror show and Golden Girls Live at the Curran Theater. And New Year's Eve will be our closing night at Oasis. We opened on New Year's Eve. We're closing on New Year's Eve. So,
and that wraps up our hour. Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.